Welcome to AM Best Audio.
This is William Borden for AM Best Audio. Thank you for joining us for this podcast, which features a discussion with Kevin LaCroix, Executive Vice President of RT ProExec and the creator of the D&O Diary blog. What prompted you to create the D&O Diary?
In 2005, I unexpectedly found myself unemployed. In very simple terms, I resigned before I got fired from my prior job. I was at odds with senior management, and it wasn't improving. And so before it collapsed entirely, I resigned. And I was without a job. And after a six-month job search or so, I decided to join two industry friends and became a wholesale insurance broker. It was a great choice and has worked out well. But when it first started, I had the difficult problem. I was a wholesale insurance broker with absolutely no business. Fortunately for me, eventually the business came, but there was a period there where I really was not producing any business for the company. And in order to keep myself occupied and keep my hand in, I decided to do some writing, which is something I've always done. But at the same time, it developed a curiosity about the technology for blogging. And at the time, there was an app available on Google called Blogger, which was free. And it took about 30 seconds to set up a blog. But I literally did it as an experiment, just out of curiosity. I had no plan that it would be something I would stay with and then nearly 20 years later I would still be doing. But I was fortunate in my timing. Right about the time I started playing around with the Blogger app was the beginning of what became known as the stock options backdating scandal. And it was much more widespread than people assumed at the beginning. But what I started doing using the blog was to keep track of how many companies and what kind of allegations. And this was a very important development for the D&O insurance industry because there was a lot of litigation. And it was a coming together of need and timing that I quickly became a source for information on stock options backdating. And stock options backdating gave way to the global financial crisis. And before I knew it, I had a large readership within the industry. None of that was planned. None of that was said, if I do this and this will happen. It was literally just putting one foot in front of the other and not worrying or even thinking about what I was accomplishing or where it was going. I certainly never had a plan that 20 years later I would still be doing it.
And I guess if you had started it 4 years earlier, you would have been writing about Enron, because it seems that
exactly. I mean,
corporate liability issues never seem to go. They might change some of their stripes,
yeah,
but they're always out there.
The truth of what you said is the reason why I'm still doing it 20 years later, because there's always something to write about. There's always another topic of the day, and so many things that you could write about that it keeps me going.
Would you say there's an information gap when it comes to directors and officers insurance in the marketplace?
I mean, everybody would always want more information. But I think in a lot of unusual ways, there's a great deal of publicly available information that's relevant in the D&O space. One obvious source I'll cite that's free and publicly available is the Stanford Law School Securities Class Action Clearinghouse. That's really valuable information for public company D&O underwriters. And, mm-hmm. There aren't good, free, trustworthy data sources like that in a lot of other liability sectors. In some ways, there's a lot of information. There's a lot more that you would want. For instance, the Stanford site is great if you're a public company D&O underwriter, but if you're a private company D&O underwriter, where do you get your information? And I think another problem for everyone in the DNO space is you have to know so many things. You not only have to know the policy and how it works, you have to know companies and how they work. You have to know corporate and securities law and how it works. You have to understand boards and board dynamics. You have to understand the litigation process. And so I think any underwriter that's been doing this, say 2 or 3 years, knows a lot of stuff that they've learned very quickly in 2 or 3 years, but every single day they're conscious of how much more they need to know. And the problem today is there's so much noise. You know, every single day you're getting information coming at you from so many directions. And in some ways, I'm part of that problem. In some ways, I'm just another source of noise. But I hope what I can do, and I'm always writing for that second or third year underwriter. That's who I'm writing to. Is not just this happened, but who cares? Why does it matter? How should it affect how you think? And I hope that people perceive that as a difference between my site and some of the other sites that are available is I'm not just telling you what, I'm telling you who cares? Why do we care? And I'm hoping that that is a reason why people might come to my site, even given all of the inundation of information they get.
Well, I think on a certain level, one, it's very clearly written to your credit, where, I mean, a lot of lawyers get a bad rap for not writing clear, concise language, mm-hmm. but you've overcome that. And I think the best lawyers tend to do that.
Thank you for that. That's sort of the highest compliment I'm really grateful that you for saying that.
And I think the other thing is that, yes, there's noise, but you also, I think your blog distills a lot of the material. So there is that notion of rather than citing, you know, 8 legal precedents, you're able to kind of boil it down to a point like, here's what's really relevant and what you need to think about.
I certainly aim for that. One of the jokes I tell on myself is I don't have time to make it shorter. If there's one thing I wish I could change, I know my blog posts are long. If I had more time, I've got a day job. I've got, tomorrow's blog post to write. If there's one thing I constantly want to try and improve is to make it shorter. And that's something I aspire to, but fail at regularly.
What would you say is the current driver in terms of blog content? I mean, would it be some of the deregulation coming out of Washington at this point, or are there other factors that I'm not really considering?
If I were to sort of make a list of the things that I think DNO underwriters should be worrying about, number one is the impact of the Trump administration. And I think that, the rapidly evolving tariff picture is illustrative, although that one is big and easy to see. I think there's some other ones that are smaller and harder to see. But my fear is that this is going to create a dynamic that not only creates operating problems for companies, but could result in litigation. But it's kind of a moving target, too. So it makes it very hard to say, precisely put your finger on, this is exactly what's going to go wrong. So I think that's issue number one. Issue number two, I think artificial intelligence is changing things. It's changing the way companies do business. It's changing the way they report to their shareholders. It's bringing about a lot of changes. It's bringing about changes in the boardroom, board processes, competition, and all of those could result in litigation. Another huge area is cybersecurity. And this one kind of dovetails with geopolitics because I fear sort of a sector-wide or even economy-wide cyber event. Mm-hmm. For example, the Iranians in retaliation for the bombing of the nuclear facilities in Iran, engineers some type of catastrophic cyber event. That would be bad at many, many levels. And it certainly could significantly affect businesses and their operations. you know, could it result in, you know, hindsight type D&O litigation? There are other areas that I think are perennial. ESG is a topic that is not only one that's been around a few years, but it's changed and it's changed and it's changed. And it's a very different topic today. Under that heading, and this actually echoes back to the first topic, what's happening with respect to DEI, I think not only creates, again, operating uncertainty for businesses, but I think potentially lays the predicate for not just potential employment practices litigation, but also D&O litigation. And I think that in this respect, some of the actions and statements of Trump administration officials has not been helpful. You know, the Department of Justice, the memo that the Attorney General put out about DEI in February was essentially a roadmap for disgruntled employees to sue their employers over DEI issues. And so there's a lot happening there that I think, you know, potentially could be the source of significant D&O claims activity. I think that short list that I've just given you shows there's always things to talk about in D&O. Each one of those we could have talked about for probably an hour, but I think they show that there's always a long list of things for D&O underwriters to be worried about.
And they seem to come in waves. And
yes.
I mean, beyond that, there's usually your run-of-the-mill shareholder suits after a profit warning, or let's say, yes. You know, so that stuff does not go by the wayside while you're dealing, you know, waiting this.
It's actually a good point. And the bulk of D&O litigation is that kind of stuff, you know, biotechnology companies that hit an unexpected obstacle in their clinical trials, you know, that's standard lawsuit. You know, those kind of stock price drop lawsuits are still being filed. It's worth thinking about that the stock market right now is at near historical levels, which in and of itself creates risk. Just setting aside all the other things we've been talking about, you know, any given company hits it, you know, stubs its toe, its share price plunges.
Oh, and, absolutely. Everything priced for perfection at this
right.
point.
Right. So that in and of itself creates risk. And the stock price drops are huge. In dollar terms, they're much larger than historical drops, which, you know, from a D&O insurer is very worrisome because it at least potentially points towards increased severity, which clearly is a concern if you're an excess insurer, because historical patterns may or may not be indicative of future patterns. And so, you know, those are all sort of background things we're thinking about and worrying about beyond sort of the topic du jour.
It seems like there's so much for executives and boards to worry about on the risks and challenges that you have to wonder about how they can grow the business.
When you have $4 trillion companies, the, you know, the kind of market cap drop that, you know, a 50% price drop implies, which is, you know, that's sort of what we've always used, the catastrophic price drop, your stock price drops 50%. Well, if you've got a $4 trillion market cap to begin with, you know, that's beyond any insurance issue.
I think some of it's just, you know, this notion of index investing and passive investing that just continues to funnel more and more money into the top 10 stocks.
Yeah.
So it kind of like one of those top 10 stocks hiccup, it kind of like shakes everything else, you know, not just that individual space, but the sector and the broader S&P 500 index, let's say.
Yeah.
Would you say some of these challenges are more pronounced now than, let's say, 25 years ago when the internet was just starting to emerge and become a thing, and you still had, you know, a regulatory backdrop that, you know, could be seen as challenging? I mean, businesses are always going to, you know, cry about
regulation. I know what you're saying. In some ways, the challenges have different names, but they're sort of all of the same cloth. I will say there are things that are different today. I think the extent to which geopolitical risks can't be ignored. There's nothing like what's going on with our tariff policy right now.
No,
There's you know so and you know I know there have been wars and will continue to be wars, but what's going on in the Middle East and what's going on in Ukraine. I worry about what could be going on in the South China Sea. Are these categorically different than the kind of exposures that were before? No, but I think they do create, collectively, they create unique operational risks for companies.
Customize your data experience. BestLink now offers an interactive company dashboard that provides company-level intelligence in a fast, user-friendly interface featuring interactive tables, charts, and Sparkline performance histories. Customize the dashboard tiles to prioritize the insurer ratings, data, and analytics that best support your workflow. AM Best. Our insight, your advantage.
Yeah, and I think that 25 years ago, you were looking at more of a, hey, everything is becoming more global, and there seemed to be this bent like, hey, let's welcome China into the World Trade Organization. Let's form the Euro. It seemed that there was this path that was heading toward greater globalization. And now it's kind of like, wait a second, here's the snapback in response to that.
You know, whether we're talking about 25 years ago or we're talking about today, there's always an element of unpredictability in corporate risk. And I think that is universal. I don't think that's going to be true 25 years from now as well. But some of the things that are unpredictable, like AI, they're categorically different. I mean, AI is sort of unprecedented. And what makes it very hard to even try and think about from a risk standpoint is it's still becoming whatever it's going to become. And no matter how good you think your crystal ball is, there's a lot that we just can't know. Businesses are going to have to make business decisions. And then in the classic formula that kind of prevails in Dino claims, the board's actions will be reviewed with 20/20 hindsight by the plaintiff's lawyers. And that has implications for D&O insurers. Your unpredictability of risk is inherent in what we do. And while that's not new, I feel like some of the unpredictability now is categorically different.
To kind of move back to the blog.
Yeah.
how would you say the blog helps RT ProExec and your position there?
Well, just starting with myself first, it's remarkable the benefit for me individually from the discipline required to write about these topics. It means that I, in a disciplined way, try to accumulate and make order out of information on these various topics. And that has the really beneficial effect that any topic comes up in a board meeting, in a transaction, in dealing with a prospect, I'm ready. I've got it organized. I've got it right at my fingertips. So it makes me much more efficient in my day-to-day job. It definitely makes me better at my job. I know that not only my colleagues, but many people in our industry read it. Which is important because I think it can create sort of a baseline of conversation. And I think that's beneficial to everyone. I think it's particularly beneficial to RT in the following way, which is, the blog and the brand of RT help each other. And particularly in the D&O space, I think it's beneficial from a branding standpoint for our company. RT is a big player, of course, but I think it helps that part of our profile in the industry is, that we're knowledge players and we're knowledgeable players. So I think that helps It helps the RT brand, and vice versa. The RT brand helps me as well.
So, yeah, on a certain level, I mean, you were creating thought leadership in 2005, well before it was in vogue.
Well before I was part of RT, actually. I didn't become part of RT until December 2010. But yeah, it's always been, even when I was on the underwriting side, it's always been sort of my approach that, we may or may not ever be the biggest, but we're going to always try to be the best. And, that's aspirational, of course. There are a lot of good players out there, and I recognize that. But, if that's sort of your approach, it does discipline your processes and how you approach day-to-day business.
And what articles seem to generate the biggest response from your readership?
Well, there's a funny anecdote that the article that by far produced the most readers was an article I wrote in fall 2011. It was during the baseball playoffs, and it just happened that coincidentally several different games in one night went into extra innings. And the last of them, all of them determined who was going to go on to the next round. And the last of them didn't end until after 1 a.m. East Coast time. And at that point, I sat down and wrote a blog post captioned "The Single Best Night of Baseball Ever?" question mark. And that blog post got over 250,000 readers. I think because the games ended so late, they, baseball fans trying to find out what happened stumbled across my blog. And so people that ordinarily never read my blog. So that's, like 25 times as many readers as I typically get. So, the irony there is that the most popular post had nothing to do with D&O insurance. I get a lot of very positive feedback, and this is very gratifying, for the posts that I write about my travels. I personally find that very satisfying because I love writing them. I would write them even if not a single person read them. But the fact that people read them and like them, and they seem to be widely read. But from the blog itself and what its goal is, my annual top 10, that I get double the usual number of readers for that. And I know it's distributed very widely and a lot of people read it because I have conversations that, the words they're using tell me they read what I'd written. So that one, I think, is at this point kind of an industry asset. That people look forward to it and read it and, talk about it. And it certainly brings me into a lot of conversations. So that's probably the most widely read from the insurance standpoint.
Yeah, and it certainly serves as a great door opener to, get those discussions started with prospects or clients, yeah. Just so you could kind of say, hey, here's the lay of the land. What criteria do you use as far as bringing outside voices into the blog?
I am always happy when someone from our industry says, gee, I've written this. Would you be willing to publish it? First of all, I realize that, the old fable about the six blind men and the elephant, I'm just one of the blind men. And I'm describing, the tusk or the tail. Other people have different viewpoints. And I think for the blog to perform the role that I want it to perform, which is sort of a platform for the exchange of information and ideas in the D&O space, having other voices just advances the goal. I try and screen for, does this person know what they're talking about? Mm-hmm. Does this person know how to write? Unfortunately, that it's a rarer skill than you would hope. Does this person have the sort of the stature or credibility to make the statements they're making? There's a strong bias in favor of publishing, honestly, for a very simple reason that I'm sure you'll appreciate. If I publish a guest post, I'm off the hook for one night and I don't have to produce one. If you read the blog regularly, there are people that regularly contribute and I'm grateful for that. I think they have their own voice. They have their own perspective, and I think it enhances the blog to have those perceptions. I have an interest personally in producing more content that's international. which may or may not be of interest to everyone that reads my blog. But I think over the long haul, the international aspect of D&O is going to become increasingly important. And so I kind of push for topics from outside the U.S. Because I would like it to be more international, both because I think it will make the blog more useful in the long haul, but I also think people in the U.S. need to know more about what's happening outside the U.S.
Right. And just because you have tariffs coming up, that doesn't mean that all international business stops. I mean, you basically, you know, by definition, a lot of these companies are multinational and they need to focus on regulation outside the U.S. because, you know, I mean, think about data protection standards in Europe versus over here. I mean, it's very well pronounced. And if you screw up over there, it's very costly.
Yeah. I mean, it's a topic for another day. But if I were to make a prediction of the single change that I see that 10 years from now will prove to be the most important, and that's the development of D&O liability risk and D&O insurance as a product outside the U.S.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And I guess certain jurisdictions are going to have to develop more sophisticated legal systems to adapt to that, I guess.
And what I would say is they are. I mean, in places like India and Singapore, Malaysia, you know, have their laws have changed. Their liability regimes have changed. The incidence of traditional D&O type claims in these jurisdictions rather than just in the U.S. You know, those are all things that are happening now. You know, for example, Singapore is a very dynamic insurance market. And India, you know, the financial market is based in Mumbai. They are a very dynamic insurance marketplace. And I think that's invisible to a lot of the folks in the U.S. But it will matter. It will matter a lot over time.
When you have a country with more than a billion people there and a rapidly growing middle class, I think it kind of demands it. And I mean, even within the United States, you're seeing a bit of jockeying among jurisdictions. I mean, to become financial hubs. I mean, you know, it used to be, well, you had a recent post about Andreessen Horowitz, you know, setting up shop in Nevada and wanting its portfolio companies to set up shop in Nevada because they think the corporate laws are a little bit more favorable there. I think there is that race.
You're right. It's a race. It's comparable in the sense that it's jurisdictional. Different, of course, because it's, you know, the U.S. is always different. Again, a topic for a much longer conversation another day. But I think the interesting question is, will, in fact, there be a shift of companies to register in Nevada or Texas or other states, by contrast to Delaware? Were it to happen, it would mean a shift in corporate law. It would mean a shift in D&O claims frequency and severity. And it would have an impact on the D&O space. So again, a topic for another day, but I mean, that you're right. That is a good illustration of how there are dynamics that are jurisdictionally based, but they could have a huge impact, not just on liability exposures, but on the insurance sector as well.
Yeah. And I think it'll place demands for business court, you know, business law to become more sophisticated, because it used to be that was the main selling point of setting up shop in Delaware, was that you knew what you would get, because the business courts are very, very well, you know, Delaware Chancery Court is very well versed in corporate law, and the judges kind of, there's nothing really new that they haven't seen before, and, you know, they'll be able to use past precedent to help rule on some of the uncertainties.
What you just said remains true. It remains that the Delaware courts are respected. And so that's a factor that may weigh against companies deciding to reincorporate. And we don't know how it's all going to play out. You know, 18, 24 months from now, some academic is going to do a study that's going to show either that more companies are registering in these other states or not. And that could have important, you know, once that statistical analysis is available, that could have important implications for D&O insurers.
And it'll also place new demands on state assemblies to, you know, figure out how to use corporate laws and incorporation rules to become a competitive pro-business.
Well, it's one of the very interesting parts of this whole debate is how dynamic the state legislatures have been. Delaware passed SB 21, which is designed to try and stem the flow. Texas and Nevada have not been idle. Their legislatures have also been passing laws that, you know, I think fairly can be characterized as innovative. So it's changing. It's a rapidly evolving dynamic. Hard to know how it's going to turn out, but we will be watching it, and it could affect the D&O space.
That was Kevin LaCroix, creator of the D&O Diary blog and executive vice president of RT Pro Exec. For AM Best Audio, I am William Borden. Thank you for joining us.
Looking to get the full attention of the insurance industry? We have the platforms that will do just that. Whether it be AM Best TV, AM Best Audio, Best Review Magazine, or Best Day. Find out more by calling AM Best Advertising Sales at 908-439-2200, extension 5399, and have a great day.